In the vacant space by the side of the house, they saw faded rags hanging on a clothesline, which was a piece of telegraph wire. Three chickens pecked among the beds of a scraggly vegetable garden. A fourth sat roosting on a bar which was a length of plumber's pipe. Two pigs waddled in a stretch of mud and refuse. The stepping stones laid across the muck were pieces of the highway's concrete. They heard a screeching sound in the distance and saw a man drawing water from a public well by means of a rope pulley. They watched him as he came slowly down the street. He carried two buckets that seemed too heavy for his thin arms. One could not tell his age. He approached and stopped, looking at the car. His eyes darted at the strangers, then away, suspicious and furtive. Reardon took out a $10 bill and extended it to him, asking, "Would you please tell us the way to the factory?" The man stared at the money with sullen indifference, not moving, not lifting a hand for it, still clutching the two buckets. If one were ever to see a man devoid of greed, thought Dagny, there he was.
"We don't need no money around here," he said.
"Don't you work for a living?"
"Yeah."
"Well, what do you use for money?" The man put the buckets down as if it had just occurred to him that he did not have to stand straining under their weight.
"We don't use no money," he said. "We just trade things amongst us."
"How do you trade with people from other towns?"
"We don't go to no other towns."
"You don't seem to have it easy here."
"What's that to you?"
"Nothing. Just curiosity." "Why do you people stay here?"
"My old man used to have a grocery store here. Only the factory closed."
"Why didn't you move?"
"Where to?"
"Anywhere."
"What for?"
Dagny was staring at the two buckets. They were square tins with rope handles. They had been oil cans. "Listen," said Reardon. "Can you tell us whether there's a road to the factory?"
"There's plenty of roads."
"Is there one that a car can take?"
"I guess so."
"Which one?" The man weighed the problem earnestly for some moments.
"Well, now, if you turn to the left by the schoolhouse," he said, "and go on till you come to the Crooked Oak, there's a road up there. That's fine when it don't rain for a couple of weeks."
"When did it rain last?"
"Yesterday."
"Is there another road?"
"Well, you could go through Hanson's pasture and across the woods, and then there's a good solid road there all the way down to the creek."
"Is there a bridge across the creek?"
"No."
"What are the other roads?"
"Well, if it's a car road that you want, there's one on the other side of Miller's Patch. It's paved. It's the best road for a car. You just turn to the right by the schoolhouse and..."
"But that road doesn't go to the factory, does it?"
"No, not to the factory."
"All right," said Reardon. "Guess we'll find our own way." He had pressed the starter when a rock came smashing into the windshield. The glass was shatterproof, but a sunburst of crack spread across it. They saw a ragged little hoodlum vanishing behind a corner with a scream of laughter, and they heard the shrill laughter of children answering him from behind some windows or crevices. Reardon suppressed a swear word. The man looked vapidly across the street, frowning a little. The old woman looked on without reaction. She had stood there silently, watching without interest or purpose, like a chemical compound on a photographic plate, absorbing visual shapes because they were there to be absorbed, but unable ever to form any estimate of the objects of her vision. Dagny had been studying her for some minutes. The swollen shapelessness of the woman's body did not look like the product of age and neglect. It looked as if she was pregnant. This seemed impossible, but glancing closer, Dagny saw that her dust-colored hair was not gray, and that there were few wrinkles on her face. It was only the vacant eyes, the stooped shoulders, the shuffling movements that gave her the stamp of senility. Dagny leaned out and asked, "How old are you?" The woman looked at her not in resentment, but merely as one looks at a pointless question. 37, she answered. They had driven five former blocks away when Dagny spoke. "Hank," she said in terror, "that woman is only 2 years older than I."
"Yes."
"God, how did they ever come to such a state?" He shrugged.
"Who is John Galt?"
The last thing they saw as they left the town was a billboard. A design was still visible on its peeling strips, imprinted in the dead gray that had once been color. It advertised a washing machine. In a distant field beyond the town, they saw the figure of a man moving slowly, contorted by the ugliness of a physical effort beyond the proper use of a human body. He was pushing a plow by hand. They reached the factory of the 20th Century Motor Company 2 miles and 2 hours later. They knew as they climbed the hill that their quest was useless. A rusted padlock hung on the door of the main entrance, but the huge windows were shattered, and the place was open to anyone, to the woodchucks, the rabbits, and the dried leaves that lay in drifts inside. The factory had been gutted long ago. The great pieces of machinery had been moved out by some civilized means. The neat holes in their bases still remained in the concrete of the floor. The rest had gone to random looters. There was nothing left except refuse, which the neediest tramp had found worthless. Piles of twisted, rusted scraps, of boards, plaster, and glass splinters. And the steel stairways, built to last and lasting, rising in trim spirals to the roof. They stopped in the great hall where a ray of light fell diagonally from a gap in the ceiling, and the echoes of their steps rang around them, dying far away in rows of empty rooms. A bird darted from among the steel rafters and went in a hissing streak of wings out into the sky. "We'd better look through it just in case," said Dagny. "You take the shops and I'll take the annexes. Let's do it as fast as possible."
"I don't like to let you wander around alone. I don't know how safe they are, any of those floors or stairways."
"Oh, nonsense. I can find my way around a factory or in a wrecking crew. Let's get it over with. I want to get out of here."
When she walked through the silent yards, where steel bridges still hung overhead, tracing lines of geometrical perfection across the sky, her only wish was not to see any of it. But she forced herself to look. It was like having to perform an autopsy on the body of one's love. She moved her glance as an automatic searchlight, her teeth clamped tight together. She walked rapidly. There was no necessity to pause anywhere. It was in a room of what had been the laboratory that she stopped. It was a coil of wire that made her stop. The coil protruded from a pile of junk. She had never seen that particular arrangement of wires, yet it seemed familiar, as if it touched the hint of some memory, faint and very distant. She reached for the coil but could not move it. It seemed to be part of some object buried in the pile. The room looked as if it had been an experimental laboratory, if she was right in judging the purpose of the torn remnants she saw on the walls. A great many electrical outlets, bits of heavy cable, lead conduits, glass tubing, built-in cabinets without shelves or doors. There was a great deal of glass, rubber, plastic, and metal in the junk pile, and dark gray splinters of slate that had been a blackboard. Scraps of paper rustled dryly all over the floor. There were also remnants of things which had not been brought here by the owner of that room. Popcorn wrappers, a whiskey bottle, a confession magazine. She attempted to extricate the coil from the scrap pile. It would not move. It was part of some large object. She knelt and began to dig through the junk. She had cut her hands. She was covered with dust by the time she stood up to look at the object she had cleared. It was the broken remnant of the model of a motor. Most of its parts were missing, but enough was left to convey some idea of its former shape and purpose. She had never seen a motor of this kind, or anything resembling it. She could not understand the peculiar design of its parts, or the functions they were intended to perform. She examined the tarnished tubes and odd-shaped connections. She tried to guess their purpose, her mind going over every type of motor she knew, and every possible kind of work its parts could perform. None fitted the model. It looked like an electric motor, but she could not tell what fuel it was intended to burn. It was not designed for steam or oil or anything she could name. Her sudden gasp was not a sound but a jolt that threw her at the junk pile. She was on her hands and knees, crawling over the wreckage, seizing every piece of paper in sight, flinging it away, searching further. Her hands were shaking. She found part of what she hoped had remained in existence. It was a thin sheaf of typewritten pages clamped together, the remnant of a manuscript. Its beginning and end were gone. The bits of paper left under the clamp showed the thick number of pages it had once contained. The paper was yellowed and dry. The manuscript had been a description of the motor.